It's Philosophy Talk.
There are three fundamental things that divide people and churches: homosexuality, homosexuality, and homosexuality.
Is homophobia mere prejudice or a justified aversion?
What does it take to have full dignity? What is human rights for us?
Why do we panic over issues of human sexuality?
Sin, disease, and moral wrong. We're dealing with very basic socialization, what people are taught.
Our guest is Gilbert Hurt, editor of Moral Panic, Sex Panics, The Fight for Sexual Rights.
The moment you allow people the option to have long-term relationships and commitment and love, you're going to get very different behavior.
Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey.
Where does homophobia come from?
It's about basic things people learn.
Gay Pride and Prejudice, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley, California, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today: gay pride and prejudice.
Our society, taken as a whole, can't seem to make up its mind about gays and lesbians. Many studies have documented increasing tolerance of homosexuality, especially among younger, more educated, more affluent, and more liberal Americans.
But on the other hand, a substantial number of Americans still don't think that gays should be allowed to marry, serve in the military, adopt, or even teach children.
The extent of how divided we are about gays and gay rights is evident in our politics.
Well, right, John, because while there's a substantial grassroots activism in favor of gay rights, surprisingly few national politicians, even politicians who are progressive on other issues, are willing to actually stand up and lead the charge in favor of gay rights.
I can't think of a single national politician who's really taken on gay rights as a cause celeb.
Well, there was San Francisco's own Gavin Newsom, our former mayor. Remember how he officiated at all those gay weddings? That was quite moving.
Yeah, quite moving, quite admirable. I don't know that it showed a lot of courage, because we're talking about San Francisco after all.
Well, yeah, that's true. And, you know, there is definitely no shortage of politicians willing to demagogue against the so-called homosexual agenda and demonize gays and their so-called lifestyle, as if there were one gay lifestyle.
Gay rights is clearly a hot-button issue, which raises the question: what are a couple of philosophers like us doing discussing gay pride and prejudice? Where's the philosophical issue there?
Well, John, our job is to ferret out hidden assumptions, to make them explicit and open, and to subject them to intense critical scrutiny. That's our job, and that's what we need to do here.
But the assumptions aren't very hidden. People who are anti-gay think that homosexuality is unnatural, morally abhorrent, a perversion, and deeply at odds with true religious beliefs.
Well, you're right, and they believe more than that. They also seem to believe that gayness is not just a private perversion, but is somehow communicable. I think that's part of why they're so opposed to gays in the military, or gays adopting, or being teachers of young children. That is, if gays were in those places, gayness would spread in ways it otherwise wouldn't.
People, on the other hand, tend to think pretty openly, they don't hide their assumptions, that sexual orientation is just one more morally neutral dimension along which people differ. People differ in race and in gender. They vary in sexual orientation too. Differences in race and gender don't mark morally important distinctions. Pretty much everyone agrees with that. And lots of people say differences in sexual orientation fairly obviously don't either.
But John, here's the question. We got two deeply opposing views. Who's right, John? But more importantly, more philosophically, how do we go about deciding who's right?
Yeah. Well, you could ask me, Ken.
And well, I'm not asking you for your personal opinion. Not at all. I'm asking about what sort of rational basis either of these two conflicting views about gayness could possibly have. I mean, how do we go about deciding, rationally deciding, whether homosexuality is, as people on the right seem to think, a morally abhorrent perversion, or more progressive people think, just a morally neutral variation in human sexual orientation. How do we decide that issue?
Well, I've got an idea. Let's ask someone who's thought long and hard about the way our attitudes towards gayness have been shaped, and the role that such attitudes have played in shaping our public discourse and our social practices.
Well, that would be our guest, renowned anthropologist Gilbert Hurt, editor of Moral Panics, Sex Panics, Fear and the Fight Over Sexual Rights. He'll join us in a little bit.
We'll also want our proud and unprejudiced audience here at the Marsh to join the conversation.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, talks to someone caught up in the moral panic over the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. She files this report.
Should gays and lesbians be allowed to serve openly in the military? The question sets both liberals and conservatives on fire, with conservative commentators like Ann Coulter and Bill O'Reilly on one side.
The combat units, the Marines and the Army, don't want gays in the military. Mm-hmm. Why can't they have it that way and we can have an all-gay division?
I've always said a don't ask, don't tell works because you don't want disruption in the barracks.
And then there are celebrities like Lady Gaga and Kathy Griffin on the other side.
The most powerful thing we can do is quite simply write a 2 or 3 page simple email telling your representatives that you won't vote for them again unless they vote for the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Ultimately, the law is being enforced using gay profiling.
And right in the middle of this debate are people like John Ferret, district commander for the San Francisco Post of the American Legion. He served in the military for 12 years, working his way up to captain. He's also gay.
When I enlisted in the Army, I signed and I checked off, I'm not gay, I'm not homosexual, I'm not interested in men, and blah, blah, blah.
Ferret enlisted in the military in 1987, well before President Clinton signed Don't Ask, Don't Tell into law in the 90s. The law was sort of a compromise. It supposedly protected gays and lesbians from discrimination as long as they remained in the closet. If anyone found out, gays would be discharged. Since the law passed in 1993, more than 14,000 service members have been dismissed for being gay. Before Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Ferret says homosexuality wasn't much of an issue beyond the usual macho anti-gay jokes.
Immediately, there was a lot of discussion. Oh, so they're going to let the fags serve now. Oh, so they're going to be allowed to run around and do whatever they want. There was this big homophobic misunderstanding that there weren't any serving before, but now suddenly they're all going to run in the military. So there were folks that had made it their mission to go out and find out who was gay and get him out.
What followed was a witch hunt. According to Ferret, servicemen drove around at night looking for Department of Defense bumper stickers on cars parked outside gay bars. There are stories of outed gay servicemen attacked and beaten.
There were the wet blanket parties where that blanket was thrown over them and they were beaten with sticks or clubs, where they were physically assaulted.
While he didn't experience the violence directly, Ferret says he lived in fear that someone would find out he was gay. He even got married to the sister of a former gay lover.
I ended up in a fortuitous opportunity where I could marry a lady who needed some help from me, and I needed what I thought, and in my own mind, what I thought was a cover. And so it actually worked out.
He got a family, his wife got a green card, and no one suspected a thing. Then one day, Captain Ferret was asked to fire a serviceman who was spotted leaving a gay bar.
And I called him in to talk about it. I really just wanted him to tell me it's a lie and I would handle that person. And he finally just said, you know what? Screw it. I'm gay. If you want to throw me out, throw me out. I can't take it anymore. I'm sick of hiding.
He says he saved the man's career by transferring him. But after that, Ferret could no longer pretend.
The easiest way for me was to say, before they come after me, I'll just go. What I did, I just transferred into the inactive reserve. And then I remained there until 99 when I resigned my commission.
While he never got the respectable retirement he wanted, Ferret doesn't regret serving in the military. And he doesn't regret resigning.
I love my country, and so does everyone else who's willing to serve under discriminatory policies, willing to put their life on the line and not even get the benefit of all the things that they're entitled to for that service.
Ferret's confident things will eventually work out for gays in the military. After all, his father served back in the 1950s when blacks were integrated into the army. Everyone thought the sky would fall, Ferret says, but it didn't. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley.
And we're joined now by Gilbert Hurt. He's a professor of anthropology from San Francisco State University, where he's founder of the Department of Sexuality Studies. He's also editor of the book Moral Panics, Sex Panics, Fear and the Fight Over Sexual Rights. Gil, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
So, Gil, why don't you start by telling us how you got interested in what you describe as the fight over sexual rights?
Well, I started in anthropology a long time ago, and when I started in Papua New Guinea, where I studied a traditional people for many years, I never saw any sign of a moral panic in the way that we would talk about it. In the 1980s, I was at the University of Chicago, started studying LGBT young people, and did the first community-based study of them and their parents, and I began to see what the impact of coming out was doing on their lives and how it would wreak havoc with them. And from that, I began to think, my God, the moral panic really is like the tsunami for human civilization. It is what can really render asunder all of the conventions, the moral things that we think is good about people.
So we want to dig into the hidden assumptions that underlie these moral panics, but why don't we start by having you tell us just what a moral panic is?
Well, let's take the difference between a moral shock and a moral panic. A moral shock is when Tiger Woods' wife famously accuses him of multiple adulterous affairs, and then he says he's a sexual addict. And we think, good Lord, the most famous sports celebrity in the world. Or when President Clinton is accused of sexual relations in the White House with an intern.
That shocked you?
That's a shock. Cigar or no cigar.
Yeah.
But a moral panic takes it further. I mean, thinking about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. When Don't Ask, Don't Tell was first implemented in the 90s, we'll remember back, New York Times coverage on the front page made clear there were Marines quoted as saying, my God, I don't want to get into the shower with a gay man because they might rape me. Or it's the Boy Scouts and people saying there are Boy Scouts leaders who are gay, they can corrupt our youth. Or it's teachers who say, I want to be a gay and lesbian openly teacher. I'm not going to seduce. I'm not going to brainwash. And this becomes a general moral fear that then scapegoats an individual, a category of people, or an episode of something. And it becomes a way of society trying to explain what is bad. And even in the language of sociologist Cohen at the time, who invented this concept in the early 70s, a way of regulating, monitoring, and even punishing people.
So we're going to have to dig into this because, I mean, I'm not sure that the people who are having this panic would agree with your characterization of their attitude. So I'm going to ask you about that a bit when we return. This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley. The topic, Gay Pride and Prejudice, with anthropologist Gilbert Hurd.
We're going to examine the nature of our attitudes towards gays and gay rights. Where do these attitudes come from? Are negative attitudes towards gays simply based on irrational fears and unfounded prejudice, or is there some factual basis for it? Could an otherwise reasonable and tolerant person have any rational basis for objecting to things like gay marriage, gay adoptions, or gays in the military?
The reasonableness or unreasonableness of our attitudes towards gays and gay rights, along with questions from our live audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Dust the Hummels in your condo hacienda. Discounts on pedicures and a soothing Brazilian wax. Come and be a part of the homosexual agenda.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing Gay Pride and Prejudice with Gilbert Hurd, editor of Moral Panics, Sex Panics, Fear and the Fight Over Sexual Rights.
What shapes our conflicting attitudes towards gays and gay rights? Can reasonable people differ over the acceptability of gay marriage, gays in the military, or gay adoption? Or are negative attitudes towards homosexuality based on completely unfounded fears and superstitions? Join us by stepping up to one of the microphones at either side of the stage.
So, Gil, I want to go back to this idea of a moral panic. I mean, it's a powerful idea, and I think there are such things as moral panics. But, you know, the people who are opposed to gay marriage or gay adoption or gay kindergarten teachers, I doubt they describe themselves exactly in the terms of fearful and panicky. I mean, so I want you to put your anthropologist hat on here. I mean, what are they missing about the real nature of their own attitudes? Are they just self-deceived or what? I mean, tell me how to think about their attitudes from a sort of anthropological perspective.
Well, if you look at the big picture, I may be old-fashioned, but I think a lot of this is really just about education. It's about basic things people learn. Take American religion today. There are three fundamental things that divide people and churches. Homosexuality.
Oh, come on. This is also abortion.
By which I mean, gays are excluded from their church because of their sexual orientation. Gays and lesbians are excluded from the clergy of particular churches, and gays and lesbians are excluded because of same-sex marriage. There are many, many other very important issues. Reproductive rights is crucial. But in terms of what's really dividing people, now where do those attitudes come from?
Right.
And how do they actually play out? I think
where they come from. I mean, again, you're an anthropologist. You're used to going to strange places, studying attitudes you don't share, and just looking at them dispassionately. I want you to look at those attitudes
dispassionately. I think that we're dealing with very basic socialization, what people are taught. If people are taught that homosexuality is a sin, a disease, or a moral wrong, which they are, they begin with that basic in life. If they're taught women are inferior, blacks are inferior, a religious or national identity is inferior, that's what they believe, all things being equal. Social scientists know the power of teaching, and individuals can oppose that, they can deconstruct that, but when it comes to these broad structural trends, it takes the institutions and the symbolic leaders to say, wait a minute, it's more complicated than that.
So we pride ourselves on being the program that questions everything. But realistically speaking, and as an anthropologist, don't societies depend on leaving some things unquestioned? And aren't basic sexual mores often among these? Don't we need to take that into account when we kind of think ill of the people that want to defend some sort of traditional straight view of things?
I think we did. And the modernization of sexuality in the past 150 years has seen an increasing attempt to sexualize moral panics and capitalize on using sexual wrongs or perceived sexual differences as a basis for demonizing people. Now, why is that? I think it's because traditional society had a whole variety of mores and prejudices, some of which were questioned or not. But as we enter into the modern period, we begin to think in a more rational, enlightened way. Well, what does it take to have full dignity? What is human rights for us? How do we really bring our children and grandchildren up in a way that is consistent with our image of goodness as a society?
So look, I agree, especially the thing you said about as we enter the modern age and modernity took greater and greater hold, and we think about the equal dignity of all human beings, and gradually, but only gradually, often with great political struggle and turmoil, we kind of held ourselves true to these ideals of the equal dignity of all human beings, and perhaps gays are the last holdout, you know, I mean, respecting the equal human dignity of gays is the last holdout of this spread of progressive thought and all that. But you're an anthropologist, so you have a sweep over, you take human beings have been around for centuries, millennia, right? And their attitudes toward one another have been around for, one could wonder whether there's something deep in the human consciousness, you know, primitive aversion or something like that to homosexuality. I mean, you know, there's a primitive aversion to incest. People give evolutionary explanations of why we have this primitive aversion to incest. I mean, would homosexuality come in for anything? Would there be any grounds in sort of just our primitive aversion that are evolved, you know, to rule that out?
There's aversions and then there's prejudices. And I won't say that there isn't a prejudice or there isn't an aversion that can be, you know, innate. What I will say is that the use of gender and sexual prejudice against gays and lesbians has clearly been an issue that has been used to divide people, to win presidential elections, to de-citizenize people, to disenfranchise them. So I think, yes, in certain human groups, there's no question there are deeply seated emotional prejudices, anger, fear, shame, and that exists in the United States. Take parents, for example. Many parents, I think, if you go back to their rejection of their children as gay or lesbian, based upon a study I did in Chicago a few years ago, what it is that they're afraid that they're going to be blamed, that something went wrong in their parenting. Why? Because sin, disease, and moral wrong. That we come back to this basic thing that people have been trained or socialized in that way.
But you can, I mean, there's at one time respectable figures like Freud that feed on people's ideas that if their child is gay or lesbian, they've done something wrong. These things used to show up in the psychiatric manual as diseases. Should we really be so hard on people who believe now things that very educated people believed 40 years ago?
Well, look, we come back to the modernization of sexuality and being sexually literate, by which I mean having the knowledge and skills to really be able to understand these issues. And that is people who once said, you know, women are inferior or given to hysteria, blacks are sexually inferior, or any other number of prejudices which once upon a time were ensconced in the DSM. In American psychiatry. But we recognize now that those sexual prejudices really were based primarily upon what people were taught.
It's the coming of rationality. It's the coming of enlightenment. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about gay pride and prejudice with Gilbert Hurd in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater. And we'd love to have questions from that audience here. And we've got a question on this side of the theater. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thanks so much. I'm Tom Merle from Napa. I have a brother who's gay, and so I'm pretty familiar with all the behavior and activities, but it seems to me that if you go beyond just sheer prejudice, and we're here in enlightened Berkeley, and look at the science of some of the behavior that causes people some chagrin who are well beyond the prejudice that you discussed, namely the sort of the biological components of male activity. And so whether you are heterosexual or homosexual, you're considerably more fired up with testosterone. And that does lead to quite a lot of activity, sexual activity. And what bothers a lot of people, going way back to the bathhouse times, was the P word, the promiscuity. Great amount of activity, sexual activity, in the face of a very serious disease. And the inability, the reluctance of the leadership and the rank and file, if you will, to defer some of that activity in the face of this disease. And that's a philosophical, ethical issue.
Gil, you want to address that?
Well, first of all,
I don't want to, so I want you to.
Well, let's make a little more explicit kind of what you're saying, because so AIDS came roughly 1776, around the 200th anniversary, it began to be recognized as something serious, although it wasn't known what it was. And there were various theories, one of which was that it came from promiscuous gay sex that somehow broke down things and so forth. So for a period, there was a lot of criticism of what you might call the gay establishment, I guess, for not coming out against promiscuity and for safe sex and so forth and so on. And I guess the suggestion is that whatever anti-gay prejudice was there before that time, that really increased it.
But I also think there's a deeper point that Tom is making, and it may be a contentious point, but there's a difference between male sexuality, whether straight or gay, male sexuality and female sexuality. And one thing that a friend of mine said about gay males is they're just guys being guys, unconstrained by the sexuality of women, because straight guys have to interact with women, and that constrains them from being what they otherwise would be. And gay guys are guys being guys. I think that's part of what's behind his question. And what do you think?
Or as one of my sociologist friends once said famously, gay men live out the fantasy of many straight men.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
But I think going back to our audience's question, first of all, gay men did change their sexual behavior quite clearly. We know that from the scientific descriptions. In the 80s, when men began to understand that there was a sexual risk, they began to protect themselves. Way before the society did warn them or help them in order to do that, because as we all remember, our society was in deep denial of AIDS and deep denial of the blame and shame game that was being attributed to gays. First it was to hemophiliacs, children who were excluded from school in a moral panic. Then it was to Haitians, then it was to bisexuals, then it was to prostitutes, and finally it was to homosexuals. And those of us who lived through that era, we remember famously when William F. Buckley whispered into the ear of President Reagan, shouldn't we tattoo and incarcerate them?
But let me ask you a kind of counterfactual hypothetical question to get at. I don't really know how to think about this, but I want your help as an anthropologist and an author of the editor of this book about if the only homosexuals there were women and their sexuality was as it was, a part of me thinks there wouldn't be as much gay. It's male sexuality unhinged to female sexuality. Not female sexuality unhinged to male sexuality, but male sexuality unhinged to female sexuality. Now, that causes people fear.
See, this is the risk, because thinking about it philosophically, I think about it very differently in the social context.
Okay.
The social context is gays have no right to be able to marry. They're expected to be promiscuous. They're expected to engage in risky sex. As long as those expectations are taught and socialized, well, why shouldn't they continue? But the moment you allow people the option to have long-term relationships and commitment and love, when you allow same-sex marriage, you're going to get very different behavior.
Are you going to get different behavior from men and women?
Yes,
men and women
absolutely.
Pattern differently?
No
Tell
question.
Me about how that
Gender
patterns.
Is a huge, huge factor here in all kinds of ways. It's a factor in terms of the ability to form relationship. It's a factor in terms of the dynamics of attraction. Testosterone is clearly a factor in this, as is prejudicial reactions. I mean, there's no question that the audience does react strongly to gay men in a way, and gay sex differently than to lesbians. I mean, this has been known from Greg Herrick's work for a long, long time. And I think beneath that is masculinity, the fear of male panic that I'm not straight enough, I'm not masculine enough. My God, people might think that I'm gay. What am I going to do?
Right. So let's get some more questions from our live audience on this side of the room. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hello. Yes, my name is John from San Jose. Actually, I'm glad Tom asked that question because it actually ties into mine. Isn't it that the reason that gay men were so promiscuous and doing all that risque sex is because homosexuality was a sin and it was against society's moral norms, and that was why they had sought that vehicle to relieve themselves? And wouldn't it be, if the society would take the pressure away with the modernization of sexuality, this would be reduced, would it not?
No question that that's a very big factor. Again, what are people learning? And how are they responding to what's sexually exciting? What's secret? What's taboo? What's forbidden? I mean, all over the world, this is a factor in sexual excitement. There's just no question about it. At the same time, if you're not allowed to have sex with adults in consenting relationships, remember, sodomy laws were still enacted all over the United States. People couldn't actually, in private, have consenting sex with other adults until Lawrence versus Texas, 2003, the Supreme Court said, no more, that's illegal.
Another question on this side of the room. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. Joshua from Berkeley. Isn't part of this maybe just the taboo about sexuality in general in America, in that with a heterosexual interaction, we can tell our children, well, a man and a woman lie together to make children. Mm. They don't lie together to have pleasure or to climax or whatever else. Whereas in gay sex, we can't sort of use that euphemism. We have to confront, well, people are lying together for, you know, carnal pleasure, which has this sort of carryover taboo because it's sexual, period, without it being gay.
So, that's a very interesting and, I think, deep question. Because, again, the way you talk about the book you edited, it talks about moral panic, and it makes it sound like, just the title, the articles are very complex, but the title makes it sound like this is all fear and ignorance. But again, that's about deeply cultural embedded views about sexuality being challenged and undermined.
You bet. I mean, that is a marvelous question. Because one of the things that happened in the modernization of sex in the last 40 to 50 years, as the Laumann et al. Study from the University of Chicago showed clearly, is sex for recreation and pleasure became more and more a middle-class norm. And prior to that time, the P word, pleasure, was dangerous. And you're absolutely right that heterosexuals in general, their conversation about these issues is about love and commitment. And as it is with gay and lesbian couples today, the latest studies from Massachusetts about gay and lesbian marriage show clearly love and commitment are the main issues. Once you begin to have an open and honest conversation about sexuality, that pleasure is part of it, that pleasure is a good thing, that people should be able to have the joy and happiness of human sexual nature, which is part of our heritage, then you change the whole conversation, and it begins to be more and more a part of, well, right. Let's let everybody at the table.
But that sounds like the sexual, for those who have left out of the sexual revolution, they're not going to be pro-gay rights or more accepting to gay rights until they get on the board of the whole sexual revolution, and that may be a big deal. But you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our guest is Gilbert Hurt. He's editor of Moral Panic, Sex Panics, Fear and the Fight Over Sexual Rights. And we're discussing gay pride and prejudice.
In our final segment, we'll ask if there's any chance of our achieving a more reasoned, less panicky public attitude about homosexuality.
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance. We'll take more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Budweiser sign, the fullback will marry the defensive line. When boys marry boys and girls marry girls, I never will marry, no, not in this world.
Welcome back to the program. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing gay pride and prejudice with Gilbert Hurt, editor of Moral Panic, Sex Panics, Fear and the Fight Over Sexual Rights.
So people object to homosexuality for various reasons. Some, I think, like a little bit like the person in Merle's song, are thinking, gosh, I mean, you know, rational women will marry women because they're so much more attractive. And men lucky enough to have the gay gene will just go off and have a lot of fun with other men without having to deal with women. And there I'll be alone. But others who probably have more faith in their own masculinity are taught by religion. And many gays themselves, that is, many homosexuals, loathe themselves for being gay. How do we deal with these prejudices that are based on such deep, historic, religiously grounded prejudices?
Well, the short answer is that we teach that everybody is equal, that everybody should have human dignity, and that people should be accepted for who they are. But the language of the song conveys a powerful trope from the two centuries of moral panics about the slippery slope. The slippery slope is you let homosexuals marry, then incest becomes legal. Right. Then you want to marry your dog and other nonsense of this kind. But this is actually a way to create a kind of humiliation and reverse reaction to regard the ridiculousness of such a case. And the second point I want to say is that let's think about the human cost of such an indignity. There are two categories of people who are terribly taking the burden of this. Young black men who are gay in the United States who have the highest rate of HIV, which is known to be associated with poor self-esteem and their rejection by families and community.
That's because, right, if you survey the African-American community attitudes toward gays, we in progressive Bay Area will be astounded by how deeply negative, deeply, deeply negative African-American attitudes are toward gays.
Including in the church. And it's the black church is so powerful and profound to the black community, as we know, and the reproduction of society in the last two centuries. But in addition is the rate of suicide by young people. This is a tragedy, an American tragedy. The number of young people who are LGBT or questioning who have thought about suicide, actually, if you go into the research, it's clear that there's a very high percentage of adults and young people who have considered this. Some have actually done it. We don't know the actual statistics because we don't know the full universe of people who are gay and lesbian.
So there's definitely a lot of human cost. There's a lot of human cost, and there's a lot of cultural resistance, and this is a hard nut to crack. And we've got a wise audience, and let's take some questions right there.
My name's Kate. I'm from Alameda. And from a family where there's one straight person, I think. I'm sort of back on the page that we were on about where does this prejudice come from. And when I was doing feminist theory, I looked a lot at the tie between control of women's sexuality and economic times, as well as some religious stuff. And I'm wondering about the social control of sexuality, that what is our vested interest? We don't have a vested interest, really, in controlling sexuality anymore. And that certainly, I think, was one of the issues with women. There was a study, I think Kroeber did it, about a tie-in between hemlines and economics. and I'm wondering if there isn't one between attitudes towards sexuality.
I want to challenge something you said. I don't think it's true that we don't. I don't know. The we is complicated because the U.S. is a complicated, multifaceted culture. Mm. I do think there are millions of people who have a vested interest in the control of sexuality. And moreover, I think there's partly a point. Our society has become so hypersexualized. And all you have to do to see how hypersexualized our society is raise a child and watch the images that stream at them from every corner, right? Every corner says sex, 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 sex. Not to adults. I mean, adults are one thing. Mm-hmm. And think of people who have not gotten with the sexual revolutions, fundamentalists, Protestants, Catholics, and you think that they don't think they have a control over the narration and representation of sex. They have a deeply vested interest. And moreover, the over-sexualization of our society is a deep challenge to them. I don't know if that automatically feeds into issues about gays and gay rights, but there, I don't know. Do you agree or disagree?
Well, first of all, I want to say that anti-gay attitudes and anti-woman attitudes go hand in hand in many societies. I mean, we can see this across patriarchal society. There's just no question. It is about regulation and control. But when it comes to the sexualization, which I profoundly agree with, this is a double-sided issue because, yes, the internet is offering to young people extraordinary images, porn images that we never had before. At the same time, a society that is so saturated with sex but no honest or transparent conversation about sex, and an official government policy that says abstinence only, which actually yeah. should be called ignorance only.
No, look, I agree. I agree with the sentiment behind that. All the stuff you said about the victims of this anti-gay is deeply moving. Mm. And if we could have a real conversation about the cost and benefits of this, but I think a part of that conversation for the people who have missed the sexual revolution, part of that conversation has to be meeting them where they are and talking about their real deep concerns about the way over-sexualization mm-hmm. of our society and the demeaningfulness of sex in this post-revolutionary era. I mean, that's what they fear. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I'm not saying those fears are all legitimate or illegitimate. They're just complicated. But we've got more questions from our live audience here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Man.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Josie Lair. I'm the director of a project called the Men's Story Project, which brings critical dialogue about masculinities into mainstream forums. And I think one thing that's important to say in this conversation is that homophobia is not just a gay people's problem. You know, it profoundly affects ways that straight men relate to each other. Mm. So if we think about all of the costs of the situation where masculinity is defined in contrast to femininity, you know, and the fact that mm-hmm. men on a daily basis have to defend and demonstrate their manhood. You know, what are all of the costs of that for men, and then in turn the people of all genders around them? If you could talk about that.
Well, let's just talk about what is perhaps the greatest cost to many women. We have an extremely high rate of sexual coercion and rape in this society. Many, many women have experienced sexual coercion, and actually the true reported rate is probably underreported because of shame and fear. And the fact is, as we talked about earlier in the incident with Marines in the shower saying, hey, I'm afraid of being raped, where clearly homophobia is a powerful weapon and a device to use. In the same way, if men have to prove that they're masculine, and if they have a homosexual panic attack because they're accused or they, in some sense, their gender behavior looks to be less than meritorious, then there's no question, in a certain way, that supports a reaction toward other people, and that includes women and the intimate people in their lives who can help them, in a sense, prove that they're
not
gay.
Let me ask you a question, drawing on your expertise as an anthropologist who's thought hard about this stuff. I mean, I don't have any deep thoughts on the question I'm about to ask you, so I'm really just wondering. So if you look at male homosexuals and male straights, and you measure them along indices of masculinity, however you measure that, as we culturally conceive of it, will you find big differences between them or not, or what?
What is masculinity?
Well, I don't know. We're throwing this around. So is there some social science measure of, quote, masculinity?
Oh, suppose you took, courage in battle, prowess in sports, ability to earn money.
Testosterone-driven behavior.
Yes, testosterone-driven
would
behavior.
Would you find a big difference in gay and straight males in the extent to which they're driven by testosterone?
Yes and no.
Elaborate.
The yes is, of course you're going to find differences, because these are different in some sense if we're talking about people who really have a sexual orientation of attraction to the same gender. On the other hand, the answer that's no is there's also going to be many similarities between heterosexual and gay men, many similarities. So do we emphasize the differences or the similarities? It's a moral and a philosophical question.
See, I mean, to me, our attitudes towards homosexuality are a problem, but there's a deeper problem that I don't think people face up to, which is men. I mean, if you look at the problems in our society, if you look at the people in prison, if you look
violence,
at the people who are
violence.
Beaten up, if you look at the violence, it's overwhelmingly men. And we know it's avoidable because,
men aren't avoidable. I'm sorry.
No, but not every man. But every little innocent baby that ends up 40 years later in prison, something happened that didn't have to happen that our society just isn't facing up to. And I think the whole gay panic thing is part of the whole crisis over what it is to be a man.
I just want to say one thing. Look at the top 10 Hollywood movies and the images of masculinity and the violence portrayed. I submit to you, people are being taught how to be masculine in ways that are really very violent prone.
So we got time for one last question. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, my name is Lisa Jean, and I realize that all of the experts up there are men, and that the speakers that have come are men. But I have worked at a gay and lesbian family camp for over 20 years. And I think we need to take the debate to another level, or at least the discussion, and bring up people who have grown up and are growing up in healthy gay and lesbian families, and families themselves are being ostracized in this society. And I think that's a really other piece of the puzzle, and maybe you guys are guys, and it's not coming up, but I want to bring it up.
I think the idea that it's not coming up because we're guys is maybe a little bit prejudiced. I
mean. Gil, do you want to say something about that?
Well, I really thank the speaker, because we haven't been able to talk about gay marriage as much as I'd hoped. And then the latest studies from Massachusetts by the Williams Institute shows very clearly the demographic profile of people being married in Massachusetts, gay, same-sex marriage. They are in their 40s. They are well-educated. A quarter of them are bringing up children. They have fairly good incomes. They want to marry for security. They want to marry for love and commitment. And I submit to you, they're not that different from middle-class folks who are getting married. And they're doing so partly because they want to have healthy, happy lives.
So again, just want to ask you a factual question. Are gay women more likely to, are lesbians more likely to marry than gay men, or is it about equal, or is there any difference?
It's interesting. Holland had the first gay, was married, my partner and I were married in Holland in 2001. My partner was Dutch. It turns out that Holland has had about 13,000 marriages since 2001, almost equally divided between males and females. And in that period of time, there's been about 1,000 divorces of these, which if you look at them is actually quite under the rate of what would be the norm.
So gay marriage is actually going to undermine the legal profession.
So on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining. It's been a really fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Gilbert Hurd. He's a professor of anthropology and sexuality studies at San Francisco State University. He's editor of Moral Panics, Sex Panics, Fear and the Fight Over Sexual Rights.
And we also want to thank everyone in our live audience for participating in the program. Give yourselves a nice round of applause.
So, John, do you have, what are your final thoughts? I thought that was a fascinating conversation. Where's your brain now?
Well, it was a fascinating conversation. On Philosophy Talk, we usually like to, give all sides a certain amount of argument, and that was kind of hard in this case because we're all have what I would regard as pretty enlightened attitudes towards gayness, but talking to Gilbert Hurt did change my views about anthropology a little bit. I mean, seemed to have a lot of faith and rationality and education for someone who's born in this relativistic discipline. But that's so I don't know. I just bless my stars. I live in California where these things are not so bad as elsewhere.
I don't have a deep, deep thought about this, but I do think there is what Gil calls a moral panic. And I think the moral panic is tied less to gay female sexuality and more to a fear about male sexuality run rampant. And I mean, I don't know if that's ignorant or informed, but I do think it's very much tied to a reaction to male sexuality not hinge to female sexuality. And I don't know if that's a deep thing or what, but I do think that's true.
And of course, a lot of it is just exploited by people like, say, Michelle Bachmann, with, I doubt, any real fears at all.
Well, that's definitely true. But this conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore, I blog. And you can also find out more by visiting our very, very active Facebook page.
And you can sign up to get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website, philosophytalk.org. For the final word, we take pride in the speed attained by Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, moral panics vary from fear of witches in Salem, Massachusetts, to fear of Jews in Nazi Germany. But not all moral panics end in death and persecution. Some moral panics end by committee. The Hays Office was set up by Hollywood producers and distributors to prevent movies from being edited or banned by whatever local community that took offense. Named for Will B. Hays, who headed the organization for over 20 years, it created the Hays Code in 1930, which stated that movies can't be sympathetic to crime, there will be no race mixing, non-marital sex could not be made appealing, and so forth. The code was abandoned in 1968 for the letter system, eventually modified to G, PG, PG-13R, and NC-17, which sounds like the name of a jet. But it is actually shorthand for no children under the age of 17 ever. This means you, pal. Because most moral panics are about protecting the children. Never mind that many children are, in fact, nasty little things. We must prevent them from seeing breasts on television. In 1954, Dr. Frederick Wortham, who had been a crusader for racial integration in the armed forces and health industries and a respected pioneer in his work with what we now call at-risk youth, published a book called Seduction of the Innocent, claiming that comic books were a major factor in juvenile delinquency. Remember juvenile delinquents? Sal Mineo, James Dean? I always thought they were kind of sexy, but apparently they were a problem. His target was mainly the horror comics produced by EC, which were full of decapitations, strangulation with entrails, and so forth, horrifying to experts, but cool to kids. But he also went after Wonder Woman, who Wortham claimed had a bondage subtext. Who knew? That Batman and Robin were gay, and that Superman was fascist. Who knew? The book led to a Senate subcommittee on juvenile delinquency, where Wortham appeared as an expert witness. Comic book publishers, backed into a corner, came up with the Comics Code, which led to the rise of strangely boring plot lines for Superman involving Bizarro World and that guy from another dimension that you can only get rid of by getting him to say his name backwards, not to mention Red Kryptonite, which would give Superman an extra finger or some damn thing. EC dropped his horror line but gave the world Mad Magazine, which in turn gave me certain words from my vocabulary as a tad in North Dakota, including Verschlagener and Patrizibi. And, of course, in the 80s, the horror comics spawned an HBO series, Tales from the Crypt, plus various R-rated movies, and The Simpsons' Treehouse of Terror episodes. Nobody reads comics anymore except collectors, but we do enjoy the big-screen adaptations of them as the nation goes back to fearing the things that really threaten the Republic. Gun control, illegal immigrants, and rock and roll. No, wait, is that still around? I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2011.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Patrick Keane and Stephanie Weissman.
Thanks also to Dan Brandon, Caitlin Esch, Joshua Raul Brody, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, and Corey Goldman.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Ben Hirsch is our director of research. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Even when they're true and reasonable, The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.